Coming up on Community Conversations on Recovery, we talk with Del McWortle of Virginia Organizing about what's happening with the school-to-prison pipeline advocacy work they're doing and the Medicaid expansion work they're doing and how that impacts and helps our community with their educational and healthcare needs. Following that, our segment of Community Recovery Calendar, talking about what's up, what's happening in the community for those seeking support services or events around mental health, substance use, or trauma recovery. And we end our show with Sammy Styles and Peer to Ear. So stay tuned. Welcome to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 Richmond Independent Radio. I'm your host, Carol Olson, and today we have Liddell McWortle. She's on the governing body of Virginia Organizing. Virginia Organizing is a nonpartisan grassroots organization who has dedicated themselves to challenging injustice by empowering people in local communities to address issues that affect the quality of their lives. Their goal is to uplift the voices of people who are marginalized. And thank you, Del, for being on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, first, let's talk about you. How did you get involved with Virginia Organizing?
You know, it's in the midst of history, I guess, because I don't remember exactly what first prompted me to get involved. But it was almost at the beginning of the organization. So it was about 20 years ago. The organization turned 21 this past August. So it was back in the 90s. I had just moved to Richmond fairly recently, didn't know a lot of people. I got involved with an organization that doesn't exist anymore called Virginians for Justice, which was a sort of precursor to what is now Equality Virginia. And Virginians for Justice got pulled into, I guess, the orbit of the new organization at that point called the Virginia Organizing Project. And we began to work with them. And I learned about the organization that way. I went to an annual meeting. I got to know the executive director, some of the organizers, some of the people that were members. And I just thought it was a fascinating organization. I loved the fact that it was multi-issue, because I had worked with single-issue organizations before. And I felt spread thin, because there's so many issues I care about, and Virginia Organizing tries to address all of them. And that's difficult, but it also makes a lot of sense. I hope we get into talking about the structure and sort of the philosophy of the organization. But anyway, that's what drew me to it. I thought this makes so much sense, to work with people across all kinds of demographic lines and to work on each other's central issues and make them our own, so that we're not just a coalition of people with different interests. We really are all interested in and see the connections among our various concerns and life situations and experiences. And it's just, I can't say how impressed I was with the organization. And I have felt that way for 20 years.
Well, let's talk about your structure. I mean, you're grassroots, you serve the entire state of Virginia. So you have your main office here, but satellite offices around the state?
Actually, the main office is in Charlottesville. The organization began in Southwest Virginia. And of course, I was living in Richmond, so that's one of the reasons I didn't know about it right away. But the idea was that it was basically a community organizing idea. You go into an area and you talk with people until it emerges in conversations, one-on-one in small groups, what it is that people in various communities need and want, and how they'd like to see their communities change for the better. And as those issues emerge, then you build sort of networks of people who may not necessarily know each other but have similar concerns. And those networks grow into bigger networks, and you end up with an organized community. So this began in Southwest Virginia, in areas that are, as you know, are still economically depressed. Lots of old coal mines there. There were also a lot of furniture factories in that area at one time. Still are some, but they were beginning to close. People were losing their jobs. Also, people were injured on the job in both of those types of employment, and with railroads and things like that. So we started working on employment compensation, unemployment compensation, workers' comp, and issues that had to do with poverty.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. Today, our guest is Ladell McWhorter on the governing body of Virginia Organizing. Now back to our show.
The idea was people often forget about Southwest Virginia here in Richmond, where, you know, we have connections with Hampton Roads and Northern Virginia and Washington. We think about all those areas when we think about Virginia. Maybe we think about the recreational areas in the Shenandoah, but we tend to forget about that area of Virginia that's almost, you know, several hundred miles away from us. And so it began there, and it began to grow toward the east. The idea was first to deal with the biggest problem of organizing in communities in Virginia across demographic lines is racism. So one of the first issues that the organization realized it had to deal with internally was the racism of people who were trying to form this network of relationships so that it would always be multiracial. And so we began developing what are called dismantling racism workshops, always co-led with people of different races, and we still do them. We do them with small groups. It has to be between 12 and 40 people at a time. They can be full-day intensive workshops or three-day over-the-weekend workshops. So we saw connections between people's inability to make their voices heard and racism, and inability to understand each other's concerns, even though there might be real overlap, and racism. So racism was always, trying to dismantle racism and speak across racial difference was always a priority for us and still is. But obviously, other concerns came up as the organization grew, took in more communities. Environmental issues, big issue, even in Southwest, and certainly it's a big issue across the rest of the state now. So we've taken on several things that were related to environment. We're doing a lot of that right now.
And now you have chapters all over the state.
All over the state, that's right.
So Charlottesville, Danville, Fredericksburg, Lynchburg, Martinsville, Southampton Roads, the Southwest where you started, and the Valley. So that's an impressive network that you've built with having a very anti-racist ideology and joining your community together on issues that affect everybody. That's impressive work.
And we've got four new chapters in formation now that are not actually established as chapters. Portsmouth, I believe Lynchburg, and New River Valley, and I think the other one is Roanoke. Did you say Roanoke? Is it established yet? It's very close.
Yeah, it looks like you have Lynchburg established, but
okay.
But so
yeah.
Good. So, wow, yeah. That's incredible. And yeah. So you've been in existence, you said
21 years. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, and we haven't got a chapter in Northern Virginia just because there are so many really active groups in Northern Virginia dealing with a lot of the issues that concern us. And so we sometimes do sort of coalition work with them. So it's not that we don't have a presence in Northern Virginia. It's more that we spread the work around a little bit.
You're listening to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. I'm Carol Olson, your host, and we're talking with Ladell McWhorter on the governing body of Virginia Organizing about their work on issues important to Virginians around the state. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to delve into some of the issues that they're working on currently. Welcome back to Community Conversations on Recovery. Carol Olson, your host, and I have Del McWhorter, governing body member of Virginia Organizing, in the studio with me today, and we're going to be diving into a couple of the issues that they're working on related to the school-to-prison pipeline and Medicaid expansion. When I look at your list of issues that you started talking about, it's massive.
Yeah, and I didn't even begin. I just told you a few.
So why don't we start with the most current one you're working on, and then we'll probably just pick a few because I'd love to talk about all of them, but I don't know that we have, if I can keep you in the studio all day talking about all of them.
Oh, it would take a long time.
What's the one you're most working on right now?
Personally, I'm most working right now on the issues that relate to climate change. Okay. But the organization is probably, we've put some effort into that in coalition with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and other groups. But we're also working on the school-to-prison pipeline, which you had mentioned before we started. That's a big one. We've just sort of finished up doing a pretty hefty multi-year campaign to get restoration of rights for citizens returning from prison or parole. So there's several things related to that, returning citizens. We've got smaller campaigns working on deaf community rights in Augusta County. Shenandoah chapter is working with Augusta Health to make sure that people have adequate support when they go for medical care, that they can hear or understand what's being told to them and what they're being asked. We got a lot of economic development issues in Southwest. So what would you like to talk about?
Well, let's talk about ending youth prisons. I mean, I think it's a fascinating topic, and I overlap in some anti-violence work and other areas that are also focused on that. So I feel like it's the thing I'm hearing people talk about. So
it's a big thing, and it's a very, very important issue. And it's a difficult one. It's hard to know where to get a hold on it and where to start tugging and pulling and trying to make a difference. I think that we began this, it's probably been between 2 and 3 years ago. It started with the Fredericksburg chapter. The chapter there is a pretty good, strong chapter, has been for a number of years. And they began to talk, as we always do. We talk, chapters talk among themselves. They individuals go out and meet with their neighbors one-on-one and try to find out what's of greatest concern in the community. And what kept coming up was parents with kids in the school system saying, you know, there's a police presence in the schools all the time. Students are getting suspended at remarkable rates. My kids are not in school because they're being suspended for things. There's a zero tolerance policy and so on. And parents were really, really upset. The kids even, you know, when they get in trouble at school, when I was in school, of course, the teacher handled it or the vice principal handled it. But very often now, they just call in the school police officer, and the police officer handles it, which means that the kid gets a police record for something they did in school, which, of course, was probably something bad most of the time, but not something that would have been caused you to get a police record.
Right. But it's such a shift in
it's terrible.
Dealing with school compliance and discipline or just educating our youth and teaching them how to be adults. I mean, that's a shift from mentoring and leading them to
policing them.
Policing them, yeah.
And understandably, parents were extremely upset about this for all kinds of reasons. And race, of course, factored into it. It's a big problem that African American kids, to some extent, Latino kids get suspended more often proportionally than white kids do. And there's lots of studies that show that that isn't because they're bad or worse than the white kids. You know, that's because teachers are harder on them or more apt to be alarmed when they're misbehaving and call in the authorities quicker. There's also some studies that suggest that that gender nonconforming girls are disproportionately suspended as well. So there's a heterosexist issue there. It's a problem. And what began to emerge in these conversations was parents saying, we've got to do something about this. And then the question was, what? So what the Fredericksburg chapter began to do, the next thing you have to do is identify who the players are who can make a decision that would make a difference.
I just want to pop in a stat for our listeners.
Sure.
So in your, or a report from the Commonwealth Institute, Virginia incarcerated youth at a rate of 75% higher than the rest of the nation, costing the state nearly $150,000 per child. And that same study found that nearly three quarters of those released were convicted of another crime within 3 years. So not only have we had such a massive culture shift here in Virginia, I mean, we are surpassing other states
That's right.
in marginalizing kids and putting them in a
basically get trapped in the system.
Yeah.
They're told that that's what their future will be.
Yeah.
And when we suspend them, we're not disciplining them so that they will not misbehave in the future. We're just telling them, get out. You don't belong here. And that's really the wrong message to send, especially when oftentimes, especially with adolescents, as everybody knows, adolescents misbehave oftentimes when they're upset about something, something at home that they need really some help with, or that they're being bullied by some other kids or something like that. So very often the problem is already that the child is upset. And when we then basically ostracize them from the school system, mark them over against their peers as different, as not as valuable or not wanted, we compound the problem that they may already have. Of course, these kids end up in trouble. That's just the way things work in the world, especially with adolescents.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Independent Radio. Today, our guest is Liddell McWhorter on the governing body of Virginia Organizing. Now back to our show. And we know from our stats from agencies in the area doing anti-violence work like Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance, local shelters like the YWCA or shelters around the state, that kids exposed to violence, either witnessing violence or victims of violence, are more likely to act out at school, to have trauma-related symptoms, and therefore take that behavior to school because they may not be safe to deal with those things that in their home environment. So that places them to be more likely to get in trouble, it looks like. So there's really that link between violence and behavioral issues that are happening in school, which is putting them to being disciplined by police instead of being served through counseling or support services. So, I mean, that really stretches out that children who are vulnerable to assault. And as you mentioned, gender nonconforming girls have higher risk, but they also have higher risks of violence.
Yes.
And so it's really stacked against them before they even get to school for this to happen. And this is this other oppressive system or barrier that's placed on them. So let's talk about what your solutions are. You started talking about what's happening in Fredericksburg. Mm-hmm. So let's circle back to that.
Okay. So in Fredericksburg, where the chapter has been working the longest on this issue, they've identified the school's the superintendent as the person who could change the policy. Because it's a school system policy. It's not a statewide policy. So they've had meetings with the superintendent, and the superintendent has agreed with them that the policy needs to be changed in some of the ways that they would like it to be changed, but hasn't yet acted on that. So what the chapter is doing now is just trying to keep the pressure on the school system. In Portsmouth, this is just beginning. They haven't yet identified the actors, but they are starting to do that. So it's getting underway in Southampton Roads and Portsmouth. Danville is also taking on this issue. The Danville chapter is another strong chapter, but they're doing it in a very different way. Danville has decided that an issue for them is what educators have been calling the achievement gap, which is that low-income and minority students end up, they may start out strong in elementary school, but they end up in the lower levels in high school. They don't take the college prep courses and so on. And that's what educators have been calling the achievement gap. Well, in Danville, the chapter members decided that they wanted to change the perception of that problem. So they're referring to it now as the opportunity gap. And what they're trying to do is identify the ways in which minority and low-income students, which is a lot of students in the Danville system, minority and low-income students tend to simply not get the same kinds of opportunities early on in their education, and that leads in high school to lower levels of accomplishment and lower levels of preparation for work or for college. So they say, look, part of the school-to-prison pipeline issue is that these kids are disaffected for reasons that don't have to do with behavior or policing, at least not in any direct way. And if that's addressed, then they can make a dent in the problem of the school-to-prison pipeline. So they're taking a very different approach from the approach that Fredericksburg is taking. They're testifying at city council meetings because they think that it's the city council in their area is the key set of key actors. So you know, these are fairly new campaigns. We think in the long term. So Danville's been working a few months. Portsmouth's just started. Fredericksburg has been working a couple of years. It takes a long time to get something this big of a problem to change.
Oh, sure, because you're trying to affect multiple systems, the mm-hmm. school system, the legal system, and our justice system.
And we have to do it one step at a time by identifying what would help right now that's possible, because we don't want to throw our efforts into something that, in fact, is not possible. We're very strategic in that way as a group, as a statewide organization. So we're trying to make incremental policy changes now. But, I mean, we can envision much bigger changes and more elaborate scenarios. I mean, one thing that you could imagine, for example, is what if instead of having police officers in schools, we used the same amount of money to have more guidance counselors, things
exactly.
like that.
Yeah.
Pretty obvious yeah. things. But that, you know, it'll take a while to get to that point. Right now, we just want to get the suspension policies changed and the ways that students are filed into categories in high school. We want to get that changed.
So what do you think caused this change in our system? Because, you know, when I grew up, we didn't have police in schools. Mm-hmm. And I mean, granted, I grew up in a small town before I moved here to Richmond, but I don't remember that anywhere in schools. And, you know, there was much more of a parents were involved in your education and part of your day at school, in a sense, if something happened, your parents were called immediately. And what changed in our culture that shifted to policing in schools? I mean, what do you think impacted that significant cultural change in America?
Well, that's a really difficult question, and I'm certainly no expert. I mean, it's this. I have the same perspective that you do. I remember school as a place that had a lot of we had a lot of problems with, but not a place where there were police officers or even metal detectors or fences. You know, it was a place that you could move freely in and out of. With supervision, of course. But things have changed. I think one of the things that has changed is that there are a lot more people who are low income now than there were, for a lot of reasons. For most middle class people, you know, as you know very well, real wages have pretty much been flat for decades now.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. Today, our guest is Liddell McWhorter on the governing body of Virginia Organizing. Now back to our show. The income gap has definitely widened,
right.
and there are more poor people and there are more lower middle class than before.
And people are falling behind and people are working more. So, you know, you may not be able to get a hold of the parent when there's a problem at school because they're working one of their two jobs and both of them are working. So there may not be time for parents to help kids with homework or to be members of the PTA. That's an issue. There's also just more stress in families, partly because of income and a variety of other reasons. There are also, I think, more problems that kids have related to environmental issues. We've been hearing all about, you know, lead poisoning in Flint and in New Jersey school systems and so on. This is a problem all over the country with an aging infrastructure. You have a lot of more environmental impacts on kids. As they develop, their systems can't take exposure to all the chemicals, the toxins that adult bodies are a little bit better able to handle. And I think we see that show up in behavior problems and illnesses. Children just not feeling well or not having a lot of energy because their lungs don't work very well. All of these things feed into this problem. And lower income kids and minority kids are more exposed to toxins, as we know from all the studies about environmental justice that have come out in the last probably 30 years.
And do you think that the disparity of resources put to schools has an impact on this as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When you have a classroom with one teacher and 35 kids, it's much, much more difficult than it is with one teacher and 25 kids. And, you know, so overcrowding, the lack of funding, teachers are stressed. A lot of teachers leave the profession early, so we have a lot of relatively inexperienced teachers in many school systems. So they're not adequately prepared, or they're frustrated, or they're totally overworked and underpaid. That's going to have an impact. And the equipment in schools, just the infrastructure of the schools themselves, can have an impact on kids' education and on kids' attitudes while they're there.
And so talking about that change, so if the changes you're working toward, you know, get to roll forth, and the dream comes true that we fix our school systems.
Yeah.
What do you think the benefit for students is? I mean, what are we looking for that's going to improve their lives?
Well, we want them, one, to be able to stay in school and complete their educations. That's the most obvious thing. And we want them to achieve at the level that they're really capable of with the support it takes to do that. Whatever their needs are, if they have physical needs that are different from some others, or if they have family problems they need help with and support with at school, we want that sort of thing to happen. But mainly, we want schools to educate them and not police them and not suspend them.
And do you have research or numbers that show that making this impact not only improves their lives and their attainment of an education, but is going to reduce their path to prison?
Yeah, I can't give you figures right this minute, but there are lots of studies that show that the higher educational levels people attain, the less likely it is that they will end up in prison. And of course, some people still do, and that there's lots of reasons for that too, that we try to address, because we don't just focus on kids. We're interested in justice and safety and support for everybody. But yeah, if we could make things better for kids, we would surely make things better for just about everybody in the Commonwealth.
And so I want to make sure we have time to talk about a couple other issues. So that's fascinating. And it was interesting for me to see that you are working on that and knowing that some other groups in tandem are working on that as well. So I look forward to having you back to talk about maybe some of the results of that work in a future show. But let's talk about something else. You talked about some of your work in healthcare with the deaf community. So that, tell me about that, because I wasn't aware that you were doing that. So that's, I think our listeners would probably love to hear.
Yeah, that's a pretty recent initiative. And it's mostly, as I said, it's in Augusta County. It happened because I'm not sure exactly how it came about. You know, we had been working on Medicaid expansion for quite a while, and we still are. But as I said, we logistically, we typically put our resources and time into things we know we can move on. And right now, with the General Assembly in stalemate, basically, we're not going to be able to move very easily. So we've been focusing on some other issues. But the Medicaid expansion was a big campaign for us statewide for quite some time. We had also worked to help with the passage of the Affordable Care Act. So healthcare is a big thing for us. People obviously will have better lives if they have better health care. So at some point while we were doing these things with Medicaid expansion, which meant going into communities and talking to people about what they needed and where they saw possibilities for change, conversation arose among some of our staff people, I believe it was, and some community members and some people in the deaf community in Augusta County. And they were saying, you know, healthcare, it's great if you can really access it, but it's very difficult for them to access it, or for some members of the deaf community to access it in their county, because it was then, because there were no services for people who with any level of deafness. So they began to talk with us, and many of them actually became involved with Virginia Organizing, and now And our staff, various people, helped figure out a strategy and just talked with hospital administrators. And as I said, Augusta Health was very receptive to that. And they figured out together a way to begin to bring interpreters and others into the hospital to work with people so that they would have access and they would understand what was happening and they could communicate their needs to healthcare professionals. It's an example of work that we do that does not require us to do legislative action or to deal with politicians and government. So we often do. People think of activism and community organizing as being political, and in a very broad sense, it is political. But it doesn't necessarily have to be political in a traditional sense. It doesn't have to be about political campaigns or about legislation. And that's one of the examples where we're working with the private sector actually has benefited a lot of people in Augusta County.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. Today, our guest is Liddell McWhorter on the governing body of Virginia Organizing. Now back to our show. So one thing that surprised me is I thought most hospitals had access to interpreters for sign language or other.
You would think so. And I assume, although I'm not sure, I assume that in Richmond, we would be able to have that. But you know, there's just not a lot of services in some hospitals outside of the major cities. There are even some areas, of course, that have lost their hospitals in Southwest because there really just wasn't funding. People can't afford health care. They don't go to hospitals unless they absolutely have to. One of the things we were hoping was with Medicaid expansion, with more people able to use Medicaid and go to hospitals in Southwest Virginia, that the hospital would be able to stay afloat.
Hearing the conversation about the Affordable Care Act, and so it looks like in pushing this forward as a means to have more people to be insured, more people to have access to medical care, you're finding some gaps that were there that weren't either identified before or weren't necessarily addressed before, even if they were identified. When you hear the backlash about Medicaid expansion with it's costing people more money for their rates, and I mean, what do you think is impacting that? Are private insurance companies raising their rates to people in order to offset the fact that they have to cover more people, or is it employers passing on rates at a higher percent to their employees to cover the fact that they insure more people? I mean, I'm a part of me is just wondering, like, where this backlash comes from, and is it really
a true statement? You're asking me a finance question.
Sorry.
But I believe that a lot of it is that insurance companies are raising rates rather than that employers are, although some I'm sure are. A lot of insurers really looked forward to the passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was one of the rare occasions when insurance companies and community organizers were oftentimes on the same side, as were hospitals. More people insured, the more people
have access, use the care,
pay for the care. So it was a nice constellation of a coalition. I think I have to say I've lived long enough to hear this argument over and over and over again. Some politicians, and the people that they influence, believe that people should just not have what they can't afford to pay for. I mean, that's a sort of, you know, okay, well, then that means that a lot of people would simply die. And I really do think that there are some politicians who take that as their health care policy. If you can't afford to pay for it, then you don't deserve it.
Health care.
Right.
So really this argument coming from the public isn't a finance argument at all.
It's a political argument.
A political argument.
Yeah. I mean, there are sectors that would lose money, and there are sectors that would get money if we had an expanded Medicaid. Now, the problem with the Affordable Care Act is that, as I understand it, which is not all that well at this point, but as I understand it, the problem is that insurance companies are raising their rates on people who were barely able to get into the system in the first place and only were able to do that through the Affordable Care Act. And part of that is because younger, healthier people, I guess, haven't enrolled at the highest rate. So the insurance companies are saying, you know, the only people that enrolled are the sick old people, and we can't afford to cover all of them. But there could be more regulation of the insurance company. And the Affordable Care Act has done a lot of really wonderful things for a lot of people, made some of our preventive treatments free, or at least forced insurance companies to cover them without co-pays and so on. The problem with the gap after the Affordable Care Act was that there were still a number of people who had too much income or didn't for other reasons qualify for Medicaid, but were not didn't have enough income to actually enter the marketplace under the Affordable Care Act for a subsidized insurance policy. And there are about 400,000 Virginians who fall into that gap. And I know several of them personally, and it's just horrible. People suffering with rheumatoid arthritis. I know a man who was laid off from the state system during the downturn, who then had a cerebral hemorrhage with some lasting effects. No health care at all. Single men, no children at home, and they can't access services at all, and they're suffering. Yeah. People who can't work, but also Social Security disability has become such a nightmare of a tangle trying to get through that many people who really do qualify can't get the paperwork done. And nowadays you need a lawyer just to apply for Social Security disability. It's a terrible system the way it's set up.
Yeah, and the overuse of ERs when there aren't available health care, or they're not clinics, or they're not doctors you can go to. And so then the higher cost of ER usage, the higher rates, which results in higher costs in hospitals. And, you know, I see that those facts going out, and you wonder why that doesn't help people change their perspective of why we need affordable health care. But we're like way over time.
I'm sorry. And we haven't even talked about so many things.
I know. So we'll have to have you back.
Well, you should have some of our members from other areas too. Fredericksburg, for example.
Okay.
Great chapter there. And we've got a new organizer in the Richmond area. Let me mention him. His name is Tyson Jackson, and he is giving a barbershop talk on November 6th at 3 o'clock at Brand New Wave, which is a barbershop, I'm told, across from Kroger Spot at 921 Hull Street. That's November 6th, 3 o'clock. He's interested in hearing what people in the area are interested in doing and changing.
Awesome. All right. And before you go, please tell people if they want to get involved with Virginia Organizing, how do they do that?
Well, they can go to our website at www.virginia-organizing.org. And they can see all the things we do there, or they can go to Tyson's program on November 6th, or they can email Tyson actually in the Richmond area. It's T-Y-S-O-N, Tyson, at virginia-organizing.org.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I look forward to having you back, and because we have a plethora of things to talk about that you do, and we encourage people to go to their website and check out all the work and get involved. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. I'm your host, Carol Olson, and today's guest was Del McWhortle, governing body member of Virginia Organizing, talking about how the work they do impacts our residents for things like school success, educational opportunities, and health care. We hope to have them back. Community Conversations on Recovery is a show dedicated to talking about recovery from mental health, trauma, and substance abuse, and the systems and providers that help our community live successful, productive lives. For more information about Community Conversations on Recovery, please go to our blog at communityconversationsonrecovery.wordpress.com or follow us on Twitter at CCR_radio. Coming up next, we'll have a short segment on what's happening in the community, who's offering what services for those of you seeking mental health, substance abuse, or recovery programs. Welcome to Community Recovery Calendar. Looking for resources in the community for substance abuse? The McShin Foundation has McShin Family Night every Wednesday, 5:30 for dinner and 6 o'clock for a community participant and family meeting. 7 o'clock is a family meeting. They have a concurrent sibling support group at 7 and a concurrent 12-step meeting for participants. For questions about joining the event, contact Heidi, 804-402-8540. Coming up November 8th, they have an educational town hall meeting talking about the effects substance abuse disorders have on families. It'll be held at the Epiphany Lutheran Church at 12:45 p.m. Contact Marta LaFleur at 677-3241 for information. For more information about peer-to-peer recovery services, contact McShin.org. Looking for resources for mental health support? Check out NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. For children and youth and young adults, they have a resource center. For upcoming program trainings, NAMI offers a family support group training on November 12th and 13th, a family-to-family training November 18th, and In Our Own Voice training December 10th. For more information to get involved, contact your local affiliate on the NAMIvirginia.org website. For youth dealing with opiate addiction, an organization that started last year called iWins, I Wish I Had Never Started, can be a resource for families and children alike. And local CSBs will provide mental health and substance abuse recovery programs for those without insurance or on Medicaid. In the Richmond area, you can call 804-819-4100 to inquire about services. Community Recovery Calendar is a segment of Community Conversations on Recovery. We'll post the calendar monthly during the show to let you know what's up and coming as resources. Thank you and stay tuned for Sammy Styles, Peer to Ear.
Hello and welcome to Peer to Ear, where I, Sammy Styles, as a person living with mental illness, share some of my experience and insight as a non-professional, non-expert peer. Today, I'd like to talk to you about RAP and Mary Ellen Copeland. RAP stands for Wellness Recovery Action Plan and is a key tool in maintaining your recovery, and it is something that I use personally to increase the quality of my life in recovery with a mental illness. RAP has many functions and tools to help us figure out many things about ourselves so that it is easier to advocate for ourselves and to help ourselves and others understand when things are falling apart, when things are fine, and what they can do to help in a crisis. But first, let's take a look at where the RAP even came from. In 1997, in Vermont, several dozen individuals who had experienced serious mental illness came together for an 8-day gathering designed to initiate dialogues on how to improve their emotional and mental health. Many of the attendees had been residents of state psychiatric hospitals at various periods in their lives. They came together to discuss practical strategies for regaining and sustaining their own wellness. A key leader in this group of pioneers was Mary Ellen Copeland, a woman who had been struggling with anxiety, depression, and extreme mood swings that had caused her to experience social isolation, economic hardship, and repeated hospitalizations. Seeking to restore her health and reclaim her life, Mary Ellen had become disillusioned with the psychiatric establishment of that time and its reliance on medication-focused treatment that prioritized managing her illness rather than facilitating her return to health. She began her own journey to find strategies for recovery by conducting a survey of her peers on the subject. From the 125 survey responses she received, Mary Ellen identified 5 key concepts to recovery: hope, personal responsibility, education, self-advocacy, and support, along with tricks for feeling better, which would later be called wellness tools, which altogether would become what we know as the RAP plan today. Let's take a look at these key recovery concepts before we look at the RAP itself. First, there's hope. People who experience mental health difficulties get well, stay well, and go on to meet their life dreams and goals. Next is personal responsibility. It's up to you, with the assistance of others, to take action and do what needs to be done to keep yourself well. Also, there's education, learning all that you can about what you are experiencing so you can make good decisions about all aspects of your life. Then, with self-advocacy, effectively reaching out to others so that you can get what it is that you need, want, and deserve to support your wellness and recovery. And finally, support. While working towards your wellness, it is up to you. Receiving support from others and giving support to others will give you help and will make you feel better and enhance the quality of your life. Now, I'm going to do a quick run-through of each segment on a RAP plan. First, there's the giant wellness toolbox. Basically, it's a list of things, including supports and coping skills, which are basic activities and tools that can help you stay feeling well. For me, I love to broadcast radio and play music. Then, we have the daily maintenance plan. Describe yourself when you are well, and a list of things you need to do every day to maintain wellness. For me, I need to take my meds, I need to make sure I get outside for a while, and things like that. Next, there are triggers, external events or circumstances that, if they happen, may make you feel uncomfortable. These are normal reactions, but if we don't deal with them in some way, they may actually cause us to feel worse. Also, we have early warning signs, internal, subtle signs that let you know you are beginning to feel worse. Reviewing early warning signs regularly helps us to become more aware of them and allow us to take action before they worsen. Next, when things are breaking down, list signs and let you know that you are feeling much worse, like feeling sad all the time or hearing voices. Using your wellness toolbox, develop a powerful action plan to help you feel better as quickly as possible and to prevent even more difficult time. Then there's a crisis plan or advanced directive that is in place for the times where you might not be well enough to make decisions on your own behalf so that you can leave detailed plans on how best to help you in that crisis. Lastly, there's the post-crisis plan, which helps you and others realize what you are like as you are becoming well again, like what helped and how. Now, if you are interested in creating a wrap plan, I have great news. Here in Richmond, there are a few nonprofits that hold wrap groups like Vocal, NAMI, Friends for Recovery, and more. Even community service boards like RBHA often hold free wrap sessions, which are anywhere from 4 to 9 weeks. This has been another installment of Peer to Ear with me, Sammy Stiles. Remember, I am not my diagnosis, and neither are you.
You've been listening to Community Conversations on Recovery, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. For more information about WRIR 97.3 FM and independent radio, to learn, volunteer, or donate, please go to WRIR.org. Thank you, and see you next week for Diversity Richmond Speaks. Community Conversations on Recovery will be back November 10th.